All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is another episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. And today we have a great returning guest. Rob Krasinski is here with us. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you guys?
Doing great. Doing great.
Listen, I'm always glad to be here.
Thank you. Yeah. It's always great to have you. The reason I asked you back is because of two of your most recent articles. I think it's important to get both of these ideas and issues out to the wider audience. So that's why I want you here. Your discourse article, Do the Populists Have a Point? And your the unpopulist article on illiberalism. I think they actually probably go hand in hand in a certain sense.
Yes, they certainly do. They certainly do. Well, because the one in the unpopulist is talking about the populist leader, Giorgio Meloni, the new populist prime minister of Italy. So it's sort of tying into what populism looks like, quote unquote populism looks like in the current era.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And now, Rob, we have closed it, at least for my view here in Sweden also. So, and more established party there. So maybe we'll come back to that, but I see the parallels. So please continue, Blair.
Yes. Yeah. I think Britain is just another quick example of populism's perhaps terrible influence. I mean, what was her name? Liz Truss. She was she wanted to be like a Thatcherite. She wanted to be a Thatcherite. And that, I guess those ideas just got blown out of the water of low taxes, less government. What do you think?
Well, okay. So, we could talk about Liz Truss in it, because she came in with thing, she was going to lower taxes, but she wasn't going to reduce any spending. And that the bond market freaked out. And as some people said, she was scuppered by the Bank of England that created this exchange rate and interest rate crisis in response to that. But it really came from the fact that she was trying to be Margaret Thatcher, but she was elected. Here's where populism comes in. That she was elected by the Tory party membership, which is this tiny little membership. It's like a couple hundred thousand people in a nation of, something on the order of 70, 80, 100 million people.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's partly has to do with how the British parties are oriented, that Boris Johnson was, you could call him a populist, but, he at least had the best character of a populist, which is he was actually popular. He actually got elected. He actually got voted into office in an election. And so he had the sort of popular mandate to do the big thing he wanted to do, which was Brexit. And when he left, they replaced him with Liz Truss, who was sort of chosen by this very interior inside the party, just a small number of people making the decision. And she didn't have popular backing. She didn't have a popular mandate. And I think that explains sort of how she lasted four Scaramucci's in office.
Right. Well, first, let's, in a broad definition, what is populism compared to like republicanism and democracy and so on?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because and I think you sent me a couple links and things like that I thought were interesting, because it is an interesting question. What is populism? Because it's a kind of an ill-defined thing, and oftentimes people don't have a clear idea what it is. Mm-hmm. I define populism as basically an idea that I think it's more of a style of politics than it is an actual agenda, because there's populism of all different types. There was something for a while that people called the Tea Party movement libertarian populism. And now with Donald Trump in America and with some other leaders overseas, you have what is a very much not a libertarian populism. It's a sort of right-wing big government populism. Mm-hmm. But we've also had times in the past when you had left-wing populism, when you had the populism was, we represent the little guy as opposed to those big businessmen on Wall Street. And so you had almost a socialist or a big government left-wing style of populism.
Sure.
So
sure.
Populism is more a style of government or style of politics rather than an agenda, because it could be a harness for different agendas. But the defining characteristic of populism, as I see it, is the appeal to we represent the people, the ordinary people, the regular man of the street, as opposed to the elites, as opposed to some sort of a real or imagined minority cabal of people who are separate from and hostile to the great mass of the people. Now,
okay, go ahead.
But in practice, now that's sort of in theory, populism is an appeal to popularity, to we represent the people, the ordinary man, the common man. In practice, and here's where one of the ways that populism goes wrong, in practice, it tends to end up referring to, well, we're for the real people. We're for real America and real Americans. We're for, it's the imagination, in the populist imagination, and one of the articles you sent me, linked to me, had a good summary of this, that basically the idea of a unitary people, the people, quote unquote, the people, you know, almost sort of put a trademark symbol on it, right? The people are one unit, and it's one unit that is supposed to all agree, and they all agree on something that just by coincidence happens to be the exact agenda that the populist leader wants to pursue at this moment. Right. So it's this idea that the people is this one entity that are all agreed, and it's only this tiny little cabal. It's George Soros, or it's small group of people in Hollywood and Washington, D.C. They're the only ones who are on the other side. And, you know, so we're for the real voice of the real people, and anybody who's not part of that imagined majority. Now, in reality, of course, there is no such unified single voice of the majority of the people. There's a whole wide diversity of opinions. So in practice, populism comes down to the idea that anyone who doesn't share the opinions of my particular faction is not a quote-unquote real American. He's one of the elites. He's one of these people, this small cabal or faction that needs to be pushed down and suppressed so that the real people can have their say. So in reality, it sort of bills itself as being we're for the people, but in reality, it always ends up being we're for a little minority or faction among the people. You know, we've got 30% or 25% or sometimes less, but people who sign up for our full agenda, but we paint them as if they are the real people and everybody else is a tiny minority. And then use that as an excuse to, you know, run roughshod over them and to suppress them. And you see that a lot in Europe, where it takes on this very overtly ethnic character of populism. You know, the real people are basically, you know, whoever has been here for a thousand years or 500 years or however far back, whoever came over with the Magyars when they first came over into Europe. Those are the real Hungarians, and immigrants and foreigners and especially refugees and people like that. Those are the threats to the real people. So it takes on this very ethnic majoritarianism, the kind of casts to it.
Well, I would say then here in America, then it would be the Christians who are trying to pick up that mantle. Then would you say that?
Absolutely.
You know, Christian nationalists, you know.
I think Christian nationalism is becoming basically kind of a mainstream philosophy of the Republican Party, unfortunately.
Sadly.
From, you know, 10, 12 years ago, you had the Tea Party movement, which I saw as a sort of rapprochement between the conservatives and the libertarian wing of the right. And, you know, the legitimately libertarian wing of the right, the small government wing of the right, focusing around economic issues and all of that. And now what's happened is sort of the religious conservatives have struck back, and they've come back and taken over the ideology of the Republican Party. And so their form of populism is real America is basically white Christian America. And they adopted this sort of Christian nationalism. But I think one of the things that's common with all forms of populism is it's an assertion, this assertion that my particular faction of people, my 20 or 30% of the voters, they're the real people, they're the real Americans, they are the unitary voice of the people themselves. It is a reaction, you know, it seems like this overclaiming that how come my little faction represents the entirety of the people? Well, I think that is in reaction to the fear underneath that in fact they are becoming a minority.
Oh, right. So, yeah, that's good. Robert, I will not interrupt you, but I do that anyway, because I was for a second almost getting depressed there. But I know that you have written in your letter two big trends, and one was the richness of a country and also the secular trend. So thanks for coming to that. Yeah. So please continue,
Rob. That's what I was coming to, which is that at the same time that the populace, the sort of right-wing populace in this country, are trying to sort of claim the majority voice of the people on behalf of Christianity, there's new polls out showing that, you know, the number of Christians in this country, the number of people who declare themselves to be Christians, is rapidly decreasing. I think just recently the number of people who describe themselves as none of the above, basically having no specific religious affiliation, some atheists, some agnostics, some simply not having any formal religious set of beliefs, those people now outnumber evangelical Christians in America. So evangelical Christians are like the most fanatical Protestant group in America. I think they are just about, they either outnumber or just about outnumber Catholics. So, and the projection is by 2050, 2060, America will no longer be a majority Christian nation. It will be more like, well, what has happened in Europe, in many European countries, where the number of sort of practicing, committed religious believers is a minority of the population, that the large population is largely secular. And so I think it's a combination of that sense of feeling like they ought to be the majority, but then fearing that they are becoming a minority, that fuels this sort of populism, that in a way they need the populism even more, because they need the fantasy that no, it's only the small minority that's causing people to be secular. We are the real Americans. We're the real majority. And if only we just asserted ourselves as the real majority, then we wouldn't have to be afraid that religious belief is going to be fading away.
And they assert themselves by appealing to government force.
And well, that's the other thing about populism, is it's always about, you know, if we represent the voice of the people, therefore we should be unobstructed. We should have the complete ability to impose whatever the people want. So majoritarianism is another ingredient of populism, which is this idea that if you represent the people, then therefore, you know, the limitations of how government procedures and protections of the rights of minorities, protections of the rights of the individual, shouldn't be brought up as obstacles. They shouldn't get in your way for whatever your agenda has to be, because after all, you know, you represent the people.
Yeah. Now, in your discourse article, I do admire how you've defended liberalism's institutions like the rule of law, limited government, obviously individualism, which is all but unknown today. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that a little bit?
In the discourse article, what I did is it sort of had an audience of one, at least when I first started out, because it's Scott Schiff, who I've done some things with for when I know that I work for the Atlas Society. He's often there as sort of like a host to introduce the clubhouses that we were doing there. Okay. Clubhouse is another one of these sort of, you know, it's sort of like a combination of a podcast and talk radio, because you get audience feedback. It's kind of nice, but unfortunately, the medium is not really growing that much, so we're sort of reevaluating what we're doing there. But Scott is sort of one who always expresses this sort of quasi-populist exasperation with the elites. In defense of the populace, basically said, what about the elites? Aren't the elites corrupt? Aren't they foolish? Aren't they, you know, don't they impose these intellectual fads on people? Basically, isn't the corruption of the elites an excuse for populism or a justification for populism? And so I was looking at that and saying, well, what about the elites? You know, part of it is I think the elites are not as bad as they're made out to be. So another aspect of populism and this idea that we represent the people as opposed to the elites is there in populism, there's a contempt for expertise. And so, you know, anyone who is in a position of authority in academia or who has worked in government or who has some sort of position where they are endowed with some kind of intellectual authority is considered suspicious just by virtue of being an expert, right? Mm-hmm. And so they love to use the term the so-called experts to imply that, you know, all these people who are experts in academia or in science or in scientific institutions, et cetera, are all frauds. They say they're experts, but they're not really experts. And that's incredibly exaggerated. So, you know, oftentimes what you end up with populism is by saying, oh, the elites are terrible. The experts don't know what they're talking about. So therefore, I'm going to do my own research. And doing my own research means, you know, watching some random guy who has a YouTube video in which he makes crackpot claims. So it's not substituting invalid expertise with real expertise. It's often throwing out all expertise and simply going on whatever you feel to be true or whatever, you know, sort of random idea has been popping around that somebody's been promoting that you either haven't tried to check or that you don't have the knowledge or the background to check.
Yeah. And, QAnon.
QAnon, because that's why you get an element of populism is these rampant conspiracy theories. Because if you don't have a base of knowledge, and you reject all the knowledge given to you by the experts and if, you know, the fact checkers and everybody else, then you're going to be, what are you left with? If you don't have your own expertise and you don't have anybody else's expertise, then you're going to have to go with, well, whoever told me what I wanted to hear most recently. That's functionally what's going to happen. And so somebody who's out there connecting the dots of some conspiracy is going to be able to get your ear. So the article is talking about that and talking about the fact that, yes, the elites do make mistakes. Sometimes things like, you know, Latinx this idea you have to refer to people of Hispanic background, who, by the way, when you poll them, overwhelmingly will tell you, we like to be referred to as Hispanic. But you say, no, the proper term is Latinx. It doesn't even make – and the greatest thing about Latinx is it makes absolutely no sense in the Spanish language, right? So it doesn't even fit in with the Spanish language. You're trying to show how sensitive you are to Spanish speakers.
I know. It's the theater of the absurd.
Yeah. So oftentimes these sort of like middle school – I said that they're like fads going through a middle school, that these weird ideas will go through the elite media or academia. And yet the problem is that the populace don't really have an alternative to that.
Right.
They don't have an alternative way of saying, well, how do we counteract what's going on among the elites? They say, no, we're going to install our own elite of sort of political demagogues. So we're gonna install our own people in power, give them even more power than anybody had under the old system. And we're gonna be selecting people not who are selected because they're greater and better experts, but they're selected because, you know, they achieved internet celebrity, or in the case of some of the older ones, tabloid journalism celebrity back in the old days.
Right.
You know, but
right.
We're going to choose people who came up through the internet or through television as celebrities. We're going to put them in place, and we're going to get a new elite that have even less expertise than the old one. So I go on to talk about how what we actually need to have as the alternative to both sort of what you might call elitism and populism is you need to have the institutions that were actually put in place as parts of a liberal society, precisely to deal with this problem. So one of the things I point out is this problem of the elites might be corrupt is not new at all. The founding fathers were very well aware of it because they were dealing with the entrenched elite of an aristocratic society. And you know, whoever had the ear of the king or whoever did the machinations to get his way up in parliament. And they were trying to come up with mechanisms that would limit the power of those people and allow competition and allow criticism. And they created all the institutions of a liberal, by liberal, I mean a free society, liberal in the political philosopher sense. And so those are the institutions that a lot of the populists want to tear down or shove off to the side and make an end run around instead of reinvigorating them and using them.
Right, right. Now, let me throw this in there real quick. There, in my mind, there has always seemed to be a strain, if that's the right word, of like anti-intellectualism in the culture. And then even Ayn Rand wrote of the breach between the intellectuals and the American people. Would that have anything to do with the rise of the populist ideas? Or?
Well, I think anti-intellectualism is... In a way, I think it's the default mode of humanity, throughout because the idea of mediating the world through ideas, of doing deep and serious thinking about a subject, is a relatively new way. I mean, you know, historically, I don't want to. So there's this sort of unfrozen caveman idea that I don't like, which is that, you know, we're all just cavemen really under the surface. And this modern sophisticated society where we deal with ideas and principles and abstractions is artificial and sits very badly on the, you know, it's sort of a, Jonah Goldberg wrote a whole book based on this where I described it as being sort of like a, it's the old conservative argument from depravity or original sin, but adapted, right? So the idea is that the original sin is we have a caveman's mind and psychology, which on top of which sits a thin veneer of intellectuality. I don't think that's true because, you know,
no.
Human beings have been thinkers from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But it is true that there is that intellectuality, that being able to think about things is an achievement. It's something that people need to learn how to do. And it's something that a culture needs to be able to support. And a culture needs to, as a whole, needs to learn how to do that. And it's often, we're often very bad at that. And there's a lot of institutional, and I see it, especially in the media business, there's, you know, I often say that the market signals from the media business to me tell me I should be running a grift. That is, I should be running a con. I should be start a podcast where I lie to people and tell them whatever they want to hear, and or start a Substack newsletter where I do that, and then I would get huge numbers of subscribers and people would love me and I'd hate my work. But but there are people out there who do that. So there is a lot of there's always this sort of ground for people who to want to be told what they want to hear, and to not want to have to think very deeply or very independently about what's going on in the world and about morality and about politics and about, you know, what ought we to be doing. So there's always that tendency of anti-intellectuality. And so I think you're always going to have that sort of populist movement underneath that sort of gives people permission to say, you don't have to think about this. Just go off, go with your emotions, go with what you feel, go with your tribal affiliation. Whichever group you happen to identify with, you can go with that. And that's all you need to do. Because, you know, it is a certain freedom from effort that populism is selling to people. You are right because you are one of the quote unquote, the people.
I hear you. Now, you mentioned the irony of the left's answer to today's elites is to hand over even more power to the unelected bureaucracy.
Well, actually, I was saying the right's answer to today's elites
is to
put our populist demagogues in place and give them more power.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
The left's answer is, or the elites on the left that they're complaining about are, yes, they're the people who become more entrenched in the permanent bureaucracy, which is a real problem that the populists are.
You're right. I was going to, I want to push back a little bit on that, but not necessarily the deep state, but the administrative state, the unelected people in the administrative state. There's so many agencies and, you know, miles and miles of laws. I know my wife who ran a business, she was constantly, well, if I do this, I break the law. But if I don't do it, I break the law. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So she had to choose. And finally, it just wore out. So, you know, but so again.
Yeah, Hernando de Soto, who dealt with this in even more chaotic environment societies, he's looking at like third world countries and South American countries. Mm-hmm. He had some very interesting things to say about that, about how basically when you have enormous amounts of regulations to start a business, and often in these Latin American countries, there'll be these tons and tons and tons of paperwork you have to fill out. And he says, basically what happens is it means that the average, you know, a poor person who's not well educated basically cannot legally start a business. Now they start them anyway. They just run them in the quote unquote informal economy, the black market economy.
Yeah,
they run them without a legal basis, but then they're always sort of on the edge of ruin because they have no legal claim to anything, right? They can be shut down at any moment. They're in a legally precarious position and they can't raise capital or take out loans because, again, they have no legal organization. So he says it ends up being basically a subsidy to lawyers and it ends up giving a monopoly to people who can afford lawyers, right? So if you are well off and can afford a lawyer to do all the amounts of paperwork, then you can legally run a business in that society. And you get all the advantages of being the one person who can legally do this. And it shuts out everybody else who could potentially compete with you. So yes, that is a serious problem. We don't have it in America as badly as they have it elsewhere, but it is a problem. And but one of the things I want to point out is that a lot of that bureaucratic administrative state, ironically, it is the leftover of a previous wave of populism.
Sure.
And sure. These are the people who actually called themselves populists with a capital P. And this is the early 20th century progressives. And they were the economic populists. They were the left-wing populists who said, oh, no, we have to have, you know, we can't have these big businessmen running amok. We have to have big government. We have to have more regulations. And they're the ones who pushed for the massive regulatory state with the idea that being, well, we're going to be tying down J.P. Morgan and all these other malefactors of great wealth. I think that was FDR's phrase. And we're going to tie them down with all these regulations to make sure they can't run roughshod over, again, quote unquote, the people.
Yeah.
So it was this economic populism that then produced big government as a reaction to, you know, the elites on Wall Street. And then, of course, big government became its own group of elites that were even less susceptible to any
permanent bureaucracy. Yeah. The permanent bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is liberalism's answer to today's epistemological chaos? That's how I look at it. It's all about epistemology, how you think about it.
Well, okay, so liberalism has several answers. And like I said, liberalism was actually developed as an answer.
Good. Yes.
You know, that if you go back to the Enlightenment and to the founding fathers and to the, you know, to the Lockean ideals that led to this. Among other things, freedom of speech was one that the institutions of freedom of speech were created as a way of basically preventing dogmas and groups of insiders from being able to control what people believe and to control what people thought was true. And so they created these standards where, you know, the standard of free speech, which is that you have to allow criticism. You can't shut out criticism. You can't ban anybody. You have to allow a vigorous debate to go back and forth. And so the institutions of freedom of speech are tremendously important. I also think political institutions, that the institution of free elections, you know, is a way of basically saying that the leaders have to answer to the people at regular intervals. They have to constantly be defending and being put on the spot for, well, you did this. And people don't like it, so why? Justify yourself. And then somebody can come up with a better argument. Free markets are one of the great liberal institutions that are meant to fight corruption. You know, the irony of the left-wing populists is they see, oh, it's free markets that are cause all these big businesses that have too much power, not realizing that actually free markets are one of the institutions that helps distribute power, because what it means is that anybody can come compete with you. And and also it means that free markets also mean that you are not dependent on the goodwill of a politician to be able to make a living and to be able to run a business and to be able to survive. And that's hugely important. That one of the we talked about the different characteristics of populism.
Right.
One of the characteristics of populism, it generally ends up leading to sort of what we used to call, very inaccurately called, crony capitalism. It's not capitalism at all. It was just called cronyism. But it's the idea that you have a system where you have a government controlled either by unelected bureaucrats or by demagogues, you know, if it's depending on your style of populism. But the government has so much control over society that in order to survive, all businesses have to basically be on good terms with whoever's in charge politically. And so you see this. I mean, the right has developed this, has adopted this. They've gotten very enamored with this idea that, well, wait a minute. You know, so Ron DeSantis and Governor of Florida basically said, well, Disney opposed me on a piece of anti-woke legislation. And so therefore, now I'm going to use my power as governor to, you know, to cause problems for them. And he went and revoked basically took it's the organization that's in charge of the utilities and the power and the sewers at Disney World in Florida, and said, well, I'm going to basically exert control over this. I'm going to appoint people as governor to run that. And basically Disney World will then be at my mercy. I can shut it down. If I don't like the way they're acting, I'll have them by the throat. And this is very much populist thinking. And, you know, of course, there's the bureaucratic left-wing version of that, because they love to do the same thing, too. But it's this idea that if you don't have free markets and everyone is dependent for their livelihood and their ability to make to run a business and make a living, they're dependent on the goodwill of politicians. Politicians get this tremendous amount of power over people and an ability to crush dissent, which we see a lot in a lot of popular sort of quote unquote populist style of dictatorships.
Right. All right. Well, that's a perfect segue into your unpopulist article about the illiberal synthesis of between which is what I call the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
The illiberal left and the illiberal right. Can you?
So the jumping off a point for that. Now, by the way, I love the fact that I just got published in the Unpopulist. Aside from the fact, I love the name of it. This is Shika Dalmia, who's a longtime libertarian writer, sympathetic to objectivism.
Nice.
She said dealings and connections over the years. Anyway, she started this thing called the Unpopulist, which is basically meant to oppose populism. But I particularly got a kick out of being published there because I've been writing unpopular things for years. So it's great that I'm in the Unpopulist. But anyway, that piece launched off with. There was a speech given by Giorgia Meloni, who was at then the presumptive. She's now the new prime minister of Italy. And, you know, her party won like 26% of the vote. But in the crazy coalition politics of Italy, that meant she got the prime ministership. And she gave this fiery speech. And the interesting thing about the speech got this huge reaction among conservatives here in America about, oh, this is a great speech. And when I looked at it, what I found is there's this conspiratorial anti-capitalism that's mixed in with the traditionalist anti-woke conservative social policy, right? So you have the conservative traditionalism, the pro-religion, pro-family traditionalism,
right,
combined with this anti-capitalist rhetoric about how, well, the reason why corporations are forcing this wokeness on us is so we'll be perfect consumer slaves and we'll be at the mercy of financial manipulators. And what I saw there, this is basically something I've been dreading for. I've been dreading this is a constant fear of mine for decades, which is that the right and left would finally discover how little difference there is between them and join forces.
Yeah, the ominous parallels.
One of the things that's helped us over the years is that the left will come with some terrible, terrible policies, and because they have these superficial differences with the right, they'll be, you know, the right will oppose them. The right has its own terrible policies, but because they disagree on certain, you know, in the style and in the oftentimes very superficial differences,
right, between them, around the margins,
they never figure out how to make common cause. And my great fear is that maybe someday they'll figure out how to make common cause, and that's why it's this synthesis of this anti-capitalist rhetoric with the social conservatism, the traditionalism that basically, you know, we should be using government to support traditional religious values and impose them on people. That is the thing that I've been looking for and I'm starting to see more signs of in the West. And I think it's the big thing to be concerned about. Now, in that piece, I also look at how that parallels a speech given by Vladimir Putin, a fairly recent one where he's reacting to the war in Ukraine, where he does the exact same thing. And in Putin's case, it's really, really funny because you can see how like a whole section of the speech is basically warmed over anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist rhetoric from his old KGB days in East Germany, right? So it's the old Soviet-style anti-capitalist propaganda, but then combined with him quoting a Russian fascist philosopher and talking about authentic cultures and traditional values. So he's doing the same thing there, where he's taken the social and religious conservatism and then combined it with parts of the old worldview of the communists, this anti-capitalist conspiracy theory that, you know, America is this horrible capitalist empire. He's taken those two and combined them. And I think that's how he's providing a model that is now being adopted by American conservatives and European conservatives.
Yeah. Now, he was even saw something where he was blessed by the Russian Orthodox Church, you know, to be, you know.
Well, he's formed a true Attila and the Witch Doctor partnership. This is one of Ayn Rand's analogies, right? You have Attila is the man of muscle and strength, and the Witch Doctor is the man of mysticism. And they have this partnership, and he's and in Russia, that partnership is totally there. It is Vladimir Putin as the mystic of muscle, the Attila, and the witch doctor in that partnership is Patriarch Kirill, who's the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church. And there's that the partnership is the Russian Orthodox Church gets official support. It gets legal support. The Russian government goes out and tries to actively suppress other religions, including other versions of Christianity. Underneath this conflict in Ukraine, there's actually a bit of a religious conflict, which is the Ukrainians, just in the last few years, petitioned to create a Ukrainian Orthodox Church that's separate from the Russian Orthodox Church. And it's under it's basically under the leadership of the Patriarch of Constantinople, who's based in Istanbul, and not the Patriarch of Moscow. So there's this sense, you know, if the Russian invasion of Ukraine had succeeded, you know, there's this sense that, well, Archbishop Kirill would have made sure that all the Orthodox churches in Ukraine were Russian Orthodox and under his control, because he's in this sort of struggle for power with the Patriarch of Constantinople.
Oh, my goodness. All right. a side story I didn't know there.
Yeah, it's something to look at. But it shows you a lot of it's something that seems medieval in a way, you know, that power struggle between the Patriarch of Moscow and the Patriarch of Constantinople. But that stuff is still there. It's still around. It's still a basis for geopolitical wranglings.
Yeah. So the answer today, though, is advance toward liberalism. Again, the rule of law, the re-embrace of individualism, and the proper definition of capitalism.
Yeah, and I also think, too, is that, you know, this, I said earlier, this is poll showing America's becoming a secular nation.
That yes.
People who call themselves Christians will probably be a minority sometime in the, you know, middle to second half of this century. And I think it also creates the need for, if we're going to be secular, we have to decide what that means. We have to have a secular ideology, a secular philosophy, a secular morality above all else. I think the thing is people, and you can see, you know, Europe became secular and it did not immediately fall apart. You know, that the way most people actually live according to, I think, a fairly decent secular morality, they live it sort of implicitly in their regular life. You know, most people go out and they get a job. They find the work they want to do. They buy houses. They have families. They do all the things that, you know, peaceful, productive, decent
normal
people would do. They live according to an implicit morality of what I would call rational self-interest or enlightened self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they don't have the theory. They don't have the idea to defend that and to define fully what that means. And that's what leads to the sense of, oh, we're going off a cliff and we don't know what we're doing.
Right, right. Martin, do you want to step in and
yes, and yes, please. Yeah, I have some short questions and also ending on. We have had a good note here in between, but also a shout out. But an expression or a word called jawboning. What's
jawboning? Jawboning.
Jawboning. You want to explain that one?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah. Jawboning is an example. So this is an example of one of these free speech issues. This is an interesting one because it's kind of a gray area or a hard to define issue. But jawboning is a word used. So, you know, the idea is you're jawboning, you're moving your jaw, you're talking to somebody. Yeah. It's sort of a slang term for talking to someone. But what it refers to is when a government official goes out and so, for example, if the example being used here is during the beginning of COVID, you had some government officials, including people from the Centers for Disease Control. So these are, you know, scientists or people in the science bureaucracy who were in charge of dealing with infectious diseases, and they were going to places like Facebook and saying, well, look, you know, these are what we see as the main sources, including sometimes specific people. We see these as the main sources of disinformation, of wrong information about COVID. And we think you should be, you know, and basically suggesting that they should do something to prevent the spread of that misinformation. And in many cases, they were actually really correct about the misinformation, that the people who were spreading this were people who were crackpots, who were, you know, denying provable scientific facts about the pandemic. But the problem comes in when you have a government official. Now, on the one hand, a government official in charge of fighting infectious diseases has a responsibility to be communicating to the public, right? It's part of his job to say, here's what we think is true and here's what we think is not true. On the other hand, whenever somebody who works for the government says something or suggests something, it's not 100% just a suggestion or just somebody's opinion. It also carries the implication that, well, maybe there would be some legal repercussions should you not comply with what I'm suggesting. And so that's, you know, one of the things that we sort of have to deal with here is that, and this technique of jawboning, it's not just a pandemic, it's been used on other things, but there's this sense of what happens when you have people who work for the government who express their opinion about what you ought to do. And even if it's not an explicit direct threat, it is still, you know, someone from the government saying, gee, it's a nice business you've got here. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it. So it could be an implicit threat. And so I had a link to some fascinating discussions about ways to sort of determine the certain legal standards. And this has been adjudicated in certain Supreme Court cases about what constitutes a legitimate quote unquote government speech. You know, the speech that's permissible for, you know, because you can't say to somebody, just because you're a politician or just because you work for the CDC, you can't state your opinion on anything.
Well,
but at the same time, you know, you have to have, like, under what conditions can you state it? Under what disclaimers do you have to state it? And I think the big issue here comes, this is another example of why you need capitalism, why you need free markets, because the less power government has to force people to do something, the less danger there is that a politician shooting his mouth off or a government official expressing an opinion could be even remotely conceived as an implicit threat, right? Because to threaten you, they have to have power over you. The less power they have over you, the less possibility that they could implicitly abuse that power.
Great. Could you clarify and tell a little bit more about the label, the new classical liberal?
Oh, neoclassical liberal.
So yeah, neoclassical. Yeah,
right.
So it's a new term, you could say, but old at the same time.
A couple of people have used it to occasionally refer to something. It never really caught on. So I figured it was available out there to be grabbed. And so I grabbed it. And so I use it as a title for my column at Discourse Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of my attempt to appeal to or try to make. So if we're going to have this alliance possibly forming of left-wing and right-wing populists, right, of the right-wing traditionalism combined with the left-wing anti-capitalism, as I'm just describing that, this illiberal synthesis, my attitude is we better have our own coalition, to a liberal coalition, to go against that, you know, and to basically if people are going to see what they have in common across party lines or across left and right lines when they're opposed to freedom, we should be make an effort to try to reach across ideological lines and across traditional sort of divides to make an alliance of liberals. And so neoclassical liberal comes from, it's sort of a portmanteau, a combination of the classical liberal. And so most people who are free marketers, or, you know, we usually describe ourselves as classical liberals. The idea is that liberal used to mean, it just, the word liberal just means pro-freedom. And so liberalism in the 19th century referred to being, you know, a pro-free marketer, being pro, basically pro free speech and free markets. That's the classical liberalism. And then in the 20th century, you know, the progressives and the populists came along, and the big government guys came along and stole the term liberal to refer to this big government ideology. Yep. But more recently, there's been a wing that calls themselves the neoliberals. And they sort of define themselves as more market-friendly. They're sort of left of center, but more market friendly. And they're more likely to be, for example, to be YIMBYs, So, you know, NIMBY means not in my backyard. It's the sort of person who opposes any development project that's happening. You want to build a 20-story apartment building, and they'll turn out at the local meeting and they'll yell and scream and try to block it, and they'll sue you. Well, these are the YIMBYs, the yes in my backyard people, where they say, no, we need to be building more housing. We need to, you know, if you don't build housing, it gets expensive, people can't afford. And sort of from a more of a left of center perspective, they said, well, we need, you know, if you're going to be able to have affordable housing for the poor, you need to be building more housing. So we should be more open to, you know, profit driven free market approaches in housing. So these are what's called the neoliberals, and they've kind of tried to make a brand out of the term neoliberal. So I said, well, what if we could get some sort of coalition or cooperation between the neoliberals, the center left neoliberals, and the center right classical liberals? And so I said, let's call that neoclassical liberalism. And so that's sort of what I'm trying to promote as a liberal synthesis, where, you know, we try to find the, you know, even though there are disagreements in philosophy and disagreements in priorities, we try to find the things that we can cooperate on and work together on. Because I think if we don't, then the advantage of forming a big coalition could potentially flip over to the illiberal synthesis that I've been working on.
Thanks for that. And you have also recently a course there on effective writing. Do you want to tell a little about that?
Yeah,
and your articles there, all your work that you're doing?
Well, yeah, so this is something I've been wanting to do for a while, because I was 20 years or so ago, I used to do a course. It was through the Ayn Rand Institute. I did a course on writing where I was dealing some. I did some with undergraduates and some with graduate students, and got a tremendous amount out of teaching that to those students, and have wanted to do it again. So a friend of mine convinced me last spring to sort of do another round of it, as she set up a group of people. And I said, well, let's, and I decided, having gone back to that and realizing, oh, I not only was able to put back together a lot of the old material that I had, but I was able to improve on it, because, you know, I've been writing for 20 years since then, doing a lot of writing, and I've learned even more. So I decided to do another round of it. So I've got a group of students going through it, just started on Tuesday. And it's one of the things that I feel strongly about, is basically having learned so much, of sort of passing on those skills and the sort of hard won wisdom, and not just about, you know, little tricks and techniques, but I've also done a lot of thinking about the process of writing. And I think most people find the process of writing to be very difficult, to be very, you know, psychologically brutal and challenging. One of the people who's interested in the class said, I think I'm actually, you know, I like the product of my writing, but I find the process to be incredibly painful and difficult. And that's exactly what I'm trying to sort of address, is there's a whole process of how you have to manage the actual act of writing, how you can break it down into sort of smaller constituent parts that are not as sort of brain-bustingly complicated or as anxiety-inducing. And so they turn it into something where you have a series of discrete steps you can take that will make it manageable. And I think it's one of the keys to doing a lot of writing, as I've done over the years, is being able to have that sort of, to know the process you need to go through to keep chugging away at being able to do it without stumbling over the process of how do you manage this ability to take this complex, a lot of facts, a lot of ideas, and you have to put them together in an order and give them a structure. How do you go about doing that? Well, I've got a series of techniques that I've developed over the years, insights into how to break that into a manageable process.
That's great. Great to hear, Robert.
Now, the funniest thing is, one of the people in the class said, well, what is your process? They asked, what is your writing process? They meant something more specific. So, you know, do you get up at 5 a.m.? Because I never voluntarily get up. I'm a night owl. I have frequently stayed up until 5 a.m.
Yeah.
So a lot of my writing is done in a dark room alone at 3 o'clock in the morning, because then nobody will interrupt you.
Hey,
I hear you about that. So we will do a bit of call to action here, and an outro, and thank a fellow podcasting called Mac Intosh. And he has a podcast called General generate wealth crypto or generation wealth crypto. Oh, okay. .com. And he sent us a boostergram, like a digital telegram with a note, and says 48 satoshis. That's a bit of a
Bitcoin, yeah.
Part of a Bitcoin, yeah. And he says, good job, gentlemen. Keep stacking those sats, Macintosh. And that was sent after the latest episode there, episode 58, and in October. So that was great to hear that, 11th of October.
Very good. So
thanks, Macintosh, for your support and for your note. And that may be something. What's your crystal ball for that, Robert, with how you could support content creators and writers and podcasters and others in a more direct, in a free way? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah. You can subscribe to my Substack. It's trzynskiletter.substack.com. They'd have to shoot me if I lose my writer's card if I don't put that out there.
That's
actually
right.
I love Substack. I love Substack as a platform. It's actually the platform. For a long time, I was basically doing a Substack, but before Substack existed, because, you know, my career sort of started at a little before the beginning of the blog era. Mm. Mm-hmm. And blogs were great, but there was no way to make money at it, right? You could put all this information out. Yep. You could get it out there for free. Yes. And people got used to everything for free. And, you know, the slogan I hate the most is information wants to be free, because it's usually set by people who are getting paid well to build the technological infrastructure, not to actually provide the information. So my view is information needs to get paid, right?
Hey,
so,
that's right.
We need to find way that people who are producing good ideas and producing good information can actually, you know, make a living at it, because there's no way I could do as much as I do if it weren't what I'm doing full time. If I were doing this, you know, on the side, I could do a small fraction of it. So finding ways that people can get rewarded for doing this. And unfortunately, in the digital era, the media business has been going the other direction. So definitely, if you have a podcast you like this one, if you have a newsletter you like, you know, subscribe to those things. Find ways to
support them.
To support them, you know, financially. Mm. But the great thing is the barriers to entry have been knocked down. They've been knocked flat.
Yeah, it's true.
Anybody with an interesting idea can go and start writing. Anybody with an interesting idea can start a podcast. So, you know, you don't have to get into the New York Times. You know, get over the parapets and the boiling oil and all of that, and to get into the citadels of the mainstream media. You don't need to get there anymore to get an audience. The downside of that is it's very hard to make money at doing it. Mm. But if you want those barriers to entry to be open, if you want people with your ideas that you like to be able to find an audience, then the responsibility goes to you individually to say, well, if I want that to happen, I should find the people I like and find ways to give them support. Again, you guys probably have like a tip jar kind of thing where people can send in support. And I've got, you know, you can subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. It's a way of supporting what I do at the various ventures that I do them.
Yep, yep. All right, Robert, we're coming up on the hour mark. So I know you've got to go. And once again, we thank you for manning the foxhole with us today.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Right, bye-bye.